യോഗേന ചിത്തസ്യ പദേന വാചാം മലം ശരീരസ്യ ച വൈദ്യകേന യോപാകരോത്തം പ്രവരം മുനീനാം പതഞ്ജലിം പ്രാഞ്ജലിരാധനതോസ്മി സ്തുവേ പതഞ്ജലിം വ്യാസം ശങ്കരം ച മുനിത്രയം കർത്തൃസൂത്രസ്യ ഭാഷ്യസ്യ കൃമാത് വിവരണസ്യ ച. So today we are entering the third discussion on the subject. So by way of reminding you of some of the points that we discussed, the first sutra is Atha Yoga Anushasanam, which says that we start instruction on yoga when we reach a stage where we look for something higher, some transcendental spiritual experience. The second sutra explains the means, yoga citta vritti nirodhaka, definition of yoga. Yoga is nothing but achieving the unity between the individual self and the universal self through complete cessation of modifications or vrittis. The third sutra says vritti sarupyam, the third sutra tada drashtuhu swarupe avasthanam. This is what happens when we succeed in reaching the stage of yoga. When we attain the yoga experience, what happens? At that time, we get completely established in our own true nature. At that point, we realize that we are something beyond the psychophysical mechanism, the body, the mind, the intellect. We are the universal, all-pervading, immanent, supreme reality. The fourth sutra says, Vritti Sarupyam Itaratra. Till we reach this state of yogic experience, we always identify ourselves with various objects. There is a long description in Patanjali's system. Of course, his commentaries, the commentaries on Yoga Sutras by Vyasa, Bhoja, Shankaracharya, and others, Vijnana Bhikshu, and others, on the different states of chittam, mind stuff. Five different stages are described. I briefly gave a description of this. Today we will describe this in greater detail. Then we go to the other sutras. As I mentioned earlier, Kshipta, Mudha, Vikshipta, Ekagra, Niruddha. These are the five Sanskrit names. I shall explain this. The first stage is this. Our mind's ideas, tendencies, all get completely scattered. Whatever we do creates a ripple, a tendency, a residual factor in the mind stuff. When we see an object, our mind takes the form of that object. That's why if you see an elephant in the zoo this morning, and when you remember that again in the evening, you can see the form of the elephant and your mind step becomes one with that elephant. Similarly, when you listen to a music this morning, 10 years later, if you remember that music, your mind stuff takes the form of that sound impression. In fact, that is the significance of the fourth sutra, Vritti Sarupyam Itaratra. Vrittis or modifications or waves within mind are always scattered, distracted in all directions. Every minute, all these five senses, whether the sense of touch, sense of hearing, sense of sight, sense of smell, and sense of taste. They drag the mind towards different objects. There is a graphic description of this phenomenon in a famous poetical work by Shankaracharya. It's called Viveka Chudamani. A very graphic description. Shabdadibhi panjabhireva pancha panjattamapusa gunena bedhaha kuranga madanga padanga meenaha brinkaha nara panjabhiranchita kim. It is a verse in Viveka Chudamani, which is in Sanskrit, sorry, in English, it is sometimes translated as the crust jewel of wisdom. That's the English translation of the title of this book. It's a book on Vedanta, Advaita philosophy. But here is a very graphic description of how our mind is distracted by the five sensory forces towards external objects, and how we become enslaved, and spiritually we meet death in the hands of the five sensory temptations. The translation is this. Five animals, five members of the animal kingdom are mentioned. Kuranga, madanga, padanga, meena, brinka. Kuranga means deer. It is said that in ancient times, the hunters used to hunt animals, and they used to play a musical instrument. Hearing this music, this sound, the deers hiding in a bush or in a cave will come out, and it will be shot by an arrow, and it will die. Now, what's the cause of its death? The cause of its death is the ear, the sense of hearing. It listened to this voice, and the mind was dragged towards that. It comes out, and it dies. With the help of this wonderful simile, the imagery, Shankaracharya gives a graphic description of the scattered nature of human mind for most of the common people in this world. Mostly we find it. Our mind goes in one direction. When we are not able to concentrate on anything, mind becomes very weak, like mustard seeds which gets scattered. Very difficult to bring together all the different seeds of the mustard. Similarly, the mind gets completely scattered. Wavering, sometimes painful memories, experiences, sometimes happy experiences. So mind is always wavering in one direction or other. The second state of mind is that of an idiot, a brute, a person who is completely confused and also who is given to lust, greed, everything related to sensory life. A person who cannot think of anything beyond the pleasures related to the sensory objects, the senses, the five senses. That is the second state of mind stuff. The third state is perhaps that describes the condition of most of spiritual seekers. On the one hand, when we read scriptures, when we go to a temple or a church and pray, when we listen to spiritual discussions, suddenly we feel a great attraction and we take a decision, well, these are very wonderful ideas, I should practice them. And then again, when we come out of the church or a temple or the meditation room, when we get back to our normal working conditions, we forget this. So the mind swings from one direction to another direction. The mind doesn't get fully focused on one central idea. But this state of mind is far superior to the two states that I described earlier. The kshipta state, the scattered, the disintegrated state of human mind, which cannot concentrate on anything. The second state, of course, the mudha state, where a person is fully focused on the most common, the lowest biological desires, sensory pleasures, nothing beyond that. Not very different from animals. The second state. The third state is certainly superior to the first two mentioned states, vikshipta state, where the mind is slowly trying to focus, concentrate on spiritual ideas. And mind does succeed to some extent. You are able to direct the five senses towards some creative, constructive channels. Sometimes we feel an inner bliss when we read a great book, when we read the Gita or the Bible or whatever scripture we are interested in, we feel ourselves transported to a higher region. When you read the Sermon on the Mount or the great teachings of the Upanishads, the universal, spiritual, humanistic ideas in the great scriptures of the world, we feel a strong desire. This is something really wonderful. We want to act according to these ideas. But then, after some time, the mind moves in the opposite direction. In Vedantic tradition, this problem is interpreted from a different angle. In Vedantic tradition, many of the later commentators explain this as a conflict between intellect and mind. Buddhi is intellect, mind is mana. See, sometimes, as I said earlier, when we read a great book, most of us feel these are very wonderful ideas, and we feel a strong desire and a willingness to practice some of these ideas. But when we try to really practice it, somehow the mind creates a stumbling block, a hurdle. Sometimes mind deceives. Many of the problems described in works like the inner warfare, the spiritual warfare, many of these books are sometimes explained in the language of satanic temptations in the Christian mystery books, the autobiographical works. Sometimes, you know, the Antichrist comes and tempts you to move away from your spiritual path. Such ideas you find in mystical literature. In Vedantic literature, they explain it from a different angle. They say, this is the problem of the conflict between mind and intellect. What we want to do and what we are able to do. What we are able to do comes from mind. And what we want to do is related to intellect. So when we listen to a great idea, a spiritual idea, when we read a book, we suddenly have a strong desire to practice it. The intellect cognizes a great spiritual idea and wants to practice. But then sometimes when we really try to do that, the mind tells us, well, let us do tomorrow. Or sometimes the mind deceives itself by, well, today perhaps I have many other things to do, so we'll do next day. Some kind of excuse the mind throws, the mind presents before us. This is a common experience among many spiritual seekers. The third state, vikshipta state, relates to that. So the commentators would tell you there is one way out. Every problem is a counter point, is counter thought. When the intellect tells you, well, we must meditate, we must discipline our lifestyle, we must place a high spiritual ideal before us, and we must discipline our thinking process, our behavior patterns, our activities, and so on. The intellect tells you. Mind doesn't agree. Mind doesn't cooperate. So Patanjali will tell you, you must go on practicing it again and again. when you read a book, you get a great idea, and you are not able to practice it. What you should do, continue reading the same book, feeding the mind with the same great spiritual ideas again and again, so that mind gets a higher percentage of positive vrittis, positive residual factors. And then it will be able to overcome the obstacles thrown up by the mind. So the mind becomes positively oriented towards spiritual practices. This is the third stage, vikshipta. Fourth state is ekagra, one-pointed concentration. You are able to focus your mind on some great spiritual idea. We slowly develop a strong desire towards spiritual ideas, towards higher spiritual practices. It is said that every human being has some strong desire. There is nobody in the world who doesn't have any desire. A student who says, well, he's not able to focus on studies, not able to concentrate on studies, it only means he has no strong desire to study, which also means he has a strong desire for something else. Because mind can never remain without some kind of focus. Even in the midst of this distraction and dissipations that we explained in the early stages, Kshipta and Mudha state, when mind is scattered, still there is an overall focus for every human being. Sensory pleasures. This attraction for sensory pleasures scatters the mind and takes the mind away from spiritual ideas. Therefore, we must go on feeding the mind, enriching the mind with more and more spiritually oriented ideas and thought currents. Then mind will have a surplus of spiritual ideas, spiritual vrittis, spiritual modifications. And more it will be drawn towards spiritual ideas, and it gets more and more one-pointed, and it slowly starts getting concentrated. That state is called, the fourth state called ekagra. If a person reaches ekagra state, he has achieved a great thing. Sri Ramakrishna once said that a person who can prepare a hookah, was a kind of maybe smoking tobacco in those days properly, he can meditate. If you can put all your mind in one area, focus all the mental energies, mental resources on one area, then that mind can also be turned to a spiritual ideas. And great scientists are able to focus exclusively on the research. Maybe it's not true today, because today you can store all the data in a computer, and we can go on holidays and vacations. But a Newton could not have done it, because Newton has to think of the scientific discoveries, the scientific ideas all the time. So he became so much obsessed with the scientific ideas that nature itself was forced to reveal some of its mysteries before him. So when mind gets completely focused on one idea, then the same power of concentration can be shifted from scientific or philosophical areas to spiritual ideas. That state is called ekagra. Niruddha state is of a spiritual state where the mind is completely emptied of all its modifications, ripples, etc. As I said earlier, whatever we do, whatever we act, whatever we speak, whatever we hear or see or touch or smell, even a casual glimpse of an object will leave a ripple in the mind stuff. Depending upon the strength of that experience, we will be able to recall that. That's why this is related to Vedanta also. we dream mostly what we experience during waking state. We can never have a dream which is completely divorced or separated from waking state experiences, but will not be a repetition of waking state experiences. For example, it takes 6 hours to reach New York from here during waking state, but in dream state, it may take maybe a split second, because in dream state, mind alone functions. In waking state, the senses also have to work, which means the action is less subtle. In dream state, the action takes place at the mental level. In waking state, action takes place at the sensory level and also the mental level. But at the same time, no dream experience can be completely separated from waking state experiences. The idea of going originated in waking state. The act of going mentally happens in dream state. So what happens? This vritti that we have stored up in our mind stuff during waking state, it comes to the surface and it relives. It is a kind of rehearsal, re-experiencing of the waking state experiences. That's why Patanjali says these residual factors, these impressions, should first of all be made one-pointed. They should be focused on one point, and finally we must be able to transcend it. The fifth stage of transcending vrittis, transcending modifications of mind stuff, is called niruddha state. We have explained this earlier, but today there are some other important topics that we had to discuss. So the fourth stage says, till we reach this yogic experience of niruddha state, transcending the modifications and vrittis, we constantly identify ourselves with whatever vrittis, whatever modifications we have gathered in our mind. That's the idea, that is the fourth state. The fifth sutra says, vrittaya panchatayaha klishtaha aklishtaha. These vrittis, these mental modifications, broadly speaking, are twofold. Some vrittis, some modifications are pleasant. Some of them are unpleasant. Some of them are painful, which is called klishtaha. Some of them are not painful, devoid of any painful experience, which is called aklishtaha. And after that, these five vrittis are explained: pramana, viparyaya, vikalpa, nidra, smritayaha. We have already explained the first one, pramana. Pramana actually means is an epistemological tool. In yoga philosophy, pramana, there are, of course, three pramanas: direct perception, then inference, and verbal testimony. These are the three important epistemological tools in yoga philosophy. In the last class, we already explained we give a broad picture of the epistemology in Indian systems of philosophy. Today, we are going to explain further some of the important points related to these pramanas. Pramanas means proofs. Pratyaksha is the first one, direct perception. When we experience something with the help of the senses and mind, it is called direct perception. You see an object in front of you when the mind and eyes come together. And then that experience creates a corresponding modification in the mind stuff. That's why we are able to remember that later. Depending upon the strength with which these experiences register themselves in the mind stuff, we are able to remember. If that experience has a very strong impact on our life, we never forget it. Sometimes, you know, we walk in the streets, we may see pebbles, stones, leaves, grass, and so on. We don't remember them. But suppose a dog chases you in the streets, and you try to run away, and if it leads to some painful experiences, and you had to be in the hospital for a day or two, you will not forget it. So this vritti becomes so strong that it becomes an unforgettable memory, which will have a permanent impact in our character. So all vrittis really constitute the essence of our character. But a very strong vritti, which registers very strongly in the mind stuff, becomes an unforgettable memory. So pratyaksha, direct perception, means a vritti created by direct perception, which means we perceive something when mind and one or all of the five senses come together. When eyes and mind come together, we see an object. When ears and mind come together, we hear a voice. Or when the sense of touch and mind come together, we see the presence of something by touching, smell, and so on. This is the first pramana. All these are vrittis. All these are modifications. Why? Because they create ripples in the citta. Citta should be compared to a lake or an ocean. You throw a stone, it creates a ripple. And that event can go on creating so many other ripples all around. Similarly, all these experiences, direct perception, inference, all of them can create some modifications in the mind. Anumana is the second one, inference. You see a sign from which you try to infer the presence of something and get a knowledge, which experience again creates a modification in the mind stuff. Mind gets accumulated by these various modifications and ripples with the help of mind and the five senses coming together. The third pramana is very important. That is a very significant special feature of the theistic orthodox systems of Indian philosophy. Agama. Agama really means the Vedas, the Upanishads. Literally, it means apta vachanam. Apta in Sanskrit means a great spiritual person who has attained his goal, who has reached his destination. Now, what are the Vedas? What are the Upanishads? What are the scriptures according to, what are the significance? Why do we consider them as an important tool, epistemological tool? Patanjali says, it's not because it's a book. That book contains the direct experiences, descriptions of direct experiences of great yogis, great spiritual scientists, spiritual teachers who have practiced this yoga and who have reached their goal, the yogic experience. So their statements, their experiences are enshrined in these Vedas, in these books. Therefore, they become authentic. So the authenticity of scriptures, like the Vedas, is based on the experience of the great spiritual teachers who have reached this goal. Apta means somebody who has reached, attained spiritual illumination, spiritual enlightenment through the path of yoga. Therefore, these books are really not books. These books are nothing but the descriptions of the experiences of the great mystics, the yogis who have practiced this yoga, the path of this yoga, and reach their spiritual goal. Therefore, they become authentic. In Vedantic tradition, yogic tradition, books are not very important. Books are important because those books indirectly will teach us how to follow this path of yoga. A person who has been traveling through one route, can easily give direction to another person who is taking the same route, trying to reach the same destination. Similarly, the aptas, the great saints and sages and mystics of ancient times, have practiced this yoga, and therefore they have reached this goal. Second point to remember is, in yogic and Vedantic tradition, when we reach a goal, spiritual illumination, spiritual enlightenment, it completely transforms our behavior, our life, our attitude towards ourselves and towards the rest of the world. When you meditate upon a God whom you describe to be compassionate, you should be compassionate. When you meditate, when you worship, when you practice a discipline which helped the great yogis to reach the highest spiritual goal, and if reaching the highest spiritual goal means reaching that transcendental spiritual experience of unity and oneness, then those qualities should be seen, should be found in the character of that spiritual seeker. If you believe in a very compassionate God and you are totally devoid of any compassion, there is something wrong in that kind of spiritual practice. If we look upon God, for example, as full of mercy and love, and the more you meditate upon that God, the more cruel we become, then there is something wrong with that kind of religion, that kind of tradition. Therefore, the third proof, the third epistemological tool in yoga philosophy is very, very important. Yoga as a philosophical system doesn't strongly affirm in the existence of a monotheistic creator God, but yoga does believe in the existence of the great spiritual teachers of ancient times who have recorded their experiences in the Upanishads and Vedas. And according to them, all these great universal scriptures speak of the great yogis, the great aptapurushas. They are almost like God who have reached the highest spiritual experience. Therefore, the more we follow this path, the more we become compassionate, humane, and we display the qualities of the great teachers whose path we are supposed to follow. So this is the seventh sutra. Now we will come to the eighth sutra. So we have described the first pratyaksha anumana agamaha pramanani. Pramanas we already explained. The second vritti is viparyaya. Now, there is a great difference between pramana and viparyaya. Pramana actually means true knowledge. True knowledge that you get either through direct perception or through inference and finally verified by the great scriptures which explain the experiences of the great spiritual teachers of ancient times. So the second vritti is viparyeha. Viparyo mithya jnanam atatrupa pradishtham. This is the sutra, eighth sutra. Atatrupa pradishtham means it is really not based on true knowledge or the reality. Mithya jnanam means false ideas, false knowledge, which is really not knowledge at all. Anything, any idea that we get, which eventually gets negated either through direct perception or through inference or through verbal testimony. That is false or knowledge or misapprehension. That's the meaning of viparya. So there are a number of examples given here. There are different types of misapprehension. There is a famous statement in the scriptures, Mrigatishnam Pasisnataha Kapushpa Dhridashekaraha Esha Vandhyasudoyadi. Simple statement, I shall explain, it is very simple. It shows what exactly viparya is, misapprehension. A person says, well, I have taken bath in what? In the water of the mirage. Now, if you travel during summertime when the sun is blazing overhead, if you travel through the desert, or if you travel through the freeway, at a distance, we may mistake that fine road, the surface of the road, to be a pool of water. This may be a kind of optical illusion, because in ancient times, they had to make use of some of these imageries. So when you look at a distance during summer season, and if the sun is blazing overhead, we may mistake the smooth surface of the road to be a pool of water. And if a person says, well, I have taken bath in that water, it means a mutual contradiction. But this is also a kind of modification. For some time, we may mistake many things in this world. We do mistake many things in this world. Again, people sometimes mistake that many of the objects seen in the sky are real. If you tell a small child during the evening, during sunset, and if there is a rainbow, if you tell the child the rainbow is a wonderful picture that somebody has drawn in the sky, the child may believe. But these are examples given in ancient textbooks for viparya. There are several other examples. So viparya means misapprehension. Or you may, when you travel in the seashore, you may mistake a mother of pearl for a piece of silver. Both look alike. The mother of pearl may appear as brilliant, as pure as the genuine silver. So one may mistake the mother of pearl for a silver. So these are some of the wrong ideas that we may experience in our life. These are also examples for vrittis. In fact, most of the time we find our mind is full of positive, genuine modifications and modifications based on misapprehension. Most of the time. Mind is an accumulation of modifications of all types. Some of them are based on genuine perception and apprehension. For example, as I said, direct perception. There's an object. You see that object with your eyes. When mind and eyes come together, genuine, it's an object that really exists. So that vritti is based on real experience. Real experience or existence of an object, which you can verify. So also, when you read a great scripture, and when you, if there is a description of some spiritual ideas, if a sage tells, well, I have followed the path of yoga, I have reached the highest goal, and then when he talks about higher spiritual things, spiritual values, spiritual ideas, then there is a genuineness. You can believe them. These are all positive vrittis. But then there are also vrittis based on misapprehension. That's the example we are given here. Often it may be due to confusion, mixing up of one for the other. Or sometimes there is another kind of misapprehension given in the old texts. If you in a dark room, there is a piece of rope, there is not enough light, but enough to see that, to know that there is something on the floor. But you don't know what exactly that object is. There is not enough light to understand that it is a piece of rope. But there is enough light to understand there is something there. And you mistake the rope for a snake. So these are all misapprehensions examples. But remember, the vritti is not so innocent. Mistaking the rope for the snake, we may run and we may go in search of a stick, and we may get excited, we will become anxious, we may be scared. So all these are possibilities based on a simple misapprehension. You mistake the rope for the snake. These are all vrittis, modifications. So all the time, every minute of life, all these vrittis are stirring the mind stuff. So that's why Patanjali said earlier, some of these vrittis are painful, some of them are not painful. Vrittis based on mental modifications based on real apprehension are not painful, but some of the mental modifications based on misapprehension are really painful. You can see many of the psychiatric problems are due to viparya. Many of the psychiatric problems go deeper and deeper if you understand the, for example, delusions of phobia, delusions of reverence. Many of these schizophrenic problems, manic depressive psychosis problems are due to misapprehensions. People who go on washing their hands again and again, kind of compulsive obsession. Something must have happened to them in the previous life. So that memory is carried over again and again. So misapprehensions. So, of course, as we go on further and further, Patanjali gives a clue as to how to fight these misapprehensions. He says, every negative thought, every painful thought, every painful vritti, tendency, mental modification, can be countered by consciously developing a counter thought. See, if somebody feels aversion towards something, and if that aversion creates problems, it could lead to many kinds of problems, obsessions, phobia. So that can be countered by helping that person to develop a counter thought, love, affection, sympathy, all these ideas. If it develops, then the negative vrittis can be weakened and eventually removed. Patanjali gives a very sound psychological tool, suggests a very interesting method. He says, every negative thought current, every negative mental modification can be countered by developing a counter mental modification. If both the modifications come together, they will balance each other. So you have to think of our mind stuff, chittam, as a bag. This bag is full of tendencies, vrittis. Some of them are very good, aklishta. Some of them are not so good, painful. The painful tendencies create problems. And suppose these painful tendencies increase, and the amount of painful tendencies exceeds the amount of other good tendencies. What happens? It creates a lot of disturbance, anxiety. So there is only one way out. Go on producing protective, constructive, creative tendencies so that the balance will tilt in favor of positive tendencies. That's why Patanjali says every negative tendency, every negative thought current, every negative behavior pattern can be countered by developing a positive, a strong positive thought current. Every bad habit can be countered by consciously developing a good habit. At least it will weaken the strength of the bad habit. It will weaken the bad habit, and to that extent, good habits will become stronger and more established. So there's an example for viparya. Then there is another vritti that is also not very helpful. Sabda jnana anupati vastu shunyo vikalpaha. This vritti is called vikalpaha. So pramana, viparya, vikalpa. This is nothing but a non-objective thought, just words. If you hear a word, and suddenly that word creates a lot of ripples in the mind, just mental constructions. You hear a word which really doesn't have a corresponding object, so naturally it is false. It is based on false or misapprehension. False apprehension or misapprehension. Non-objective thoughts. Normally, every thought should have a corresponding object. That is a normal rule. When we think of an object, we can never think of it without a corresponding word with which we try to call that object. If you have seen an animal in the zoo, and if you don't know its name, in the evening when you think of that animal, you may think, I have seen an animal, the name of which I don't know, what kind of animal. So this word formation becomes its name. When you come to know this animal is the particular, it's got a specific name, then it is replaced by the proper name of the animal. Anyhow, whatever thought we have in our mind, will have its corresponding objects, normally speaking. But there are occasions when we hear a word which is really without any object, corresponding object, immediately, without understanding the reality of the situation, we become angry, we become anxious, we become apprehensive. We become happy or unhappy. This is also a kind of a vritti, and not a very helpful vritti. So all these vrittis will get accumulated in the mind stuff. And so long as these vrittis get accumulated, the mind can never be happy. We can never be happy. Every time, every minute, our mind is thinking and our mind is trying to objectify imaginary things, and when we imagine things, our mind takes the form of those objects. When we imagine, our mind will actually take the form of that object. That's why vrittisarupyam itaratra, you find it third sutra. If we don't get fully established in the samadhi state, in the yogic state, till we reach that state of enlightenment, our mind is always being scattered, full of scattered, disintegrated, fragmented thought currents and tendencies and modifications. And when we see an object, when we hear something, when we touch something, when we smell something, or when we taste something, every minute our mind takes the form of those experiences. And they go on creating mental ripples. Patanjali is trying to suggest a method by which we can calm down this wavering, these ripples which are going on, which are moving up and down in the mind stuff. So today we have almost reached the time. So we can have interaction. You can ask any question based on what I explained today or what I explained the last two sessions. Any questions? Some of the ideas may not be very clear. I can repeat again any number of times. in this class, if there is no time, next class. So if ideas are not very clear, you are most welcome to give your suggestions and I can verify, repeat the ideas what I say again. Niruddha, you mean? Oh, you mean here, what I said here. Oh, yeah.
You were talking about objects such as ghosts.
Oh,
yes.
Or
delusions.
Yes, or yes. Yeah. Yes. In fact, that is more related to the fourth one, we call viparyaya. Shabda jnana anupadi vastu shunya vikalpaka, non-objective. In fact, they may belong to both the categories. See, about ghost or delusions are false thoughts. I don't know into which category we can place the ghosts, because there is a good number of people who believe in the existence of ghosts. But delusions can be scientifically explained, because it's a subject in psychiatry and also psychology. Delusions are false thoughts, false ideas. They mostly emerge due to psychological problems or the practice of yoga without proper discipline. As I said earlier, if a person tries to practice the Ashtanga yoga, meditation, breathing exercises and all that, without a teacher or without proper dietary discipline in life, the nervous system gets activated. That can create problems of delusions, false thoughts. Prophet syndrome is a common problem among the practitioners of yoga who are adventurous enough to read books and start straight away practicing these things. Prophet syndrome. Suddenly you feel you have a great mission to fulfill all these ideas. These are very common things. They can recall delusions of grandeur are very common among the practitioners. Delusions of grandeur, those who practice this. It's a kind of viparyaya. It's an example of viparyaya. As I said, you claim to have taken a bath in the water, imaginary water, or you have seen an angel suddenly appearing before you. Now, I can give an example. Patanjali says one positive proof is aptavajanam, which means verbal testimony, which means agama, statements, experiences of great sages. Now, if you read those books, you can verify yourself. Those who claim to have reached the highest yoga, if they speak things which are obviously not conducive to spiritual ideas, there is something wrong with that. It is a kind of delusion. Swami Vivekananda makes an interesting statement in Inspired Talks. If somebody comes and tells you he's inspired and talks nonsense, reject him. This is Swamiji makes a statement. Somebody wanted a clarification of this idea. Swamiji said, well, suppose you talk about great spiritual achievement, and then if your words and your behavior, your character are not conducive, not in line with those spiritual ideas, you say you have realized a God who is all-merciful, kind, compassionate, and you yourself become very cruel and inhuman. So there is a contradiction. So Swamiji says that yogic experience doesn't contradict reason, but goes beyond reason. Yoga is based on experience. Experience is the testimony. Experience, real experience, is the basis of verbal testimony as a proof, as an epistemological tool. Now, in those books, you never come across delusions or any of the phobias and all that. So all these are due to either indiscipline, practice of yoga, or irrational understanding of experience. That's why spirituality or yogi experience never contradicts reason, but goes beyond reason. It's never in conflict with reason. So that's why Vivekananda said once more, if a person claims to have reached highest yogic inspiration or experience, and still if his words are not in tune with the fundamental ideas of yoga, then there is a contradiction, inherent contradiction. So phobias are mostly due to the practice. Not all phobias, mind you. There are pathological cases, but I'm talking about there is a possibility of people developing delusions if they practice without proper discipline. That's the idea. So viparya is a classic example. Viparya, short temper. Suddenly you hear something which has really no basis, and immediately you react. It's a vritti, an example for the fifth one. Sabdajnananupadi vastasunya vikalpa. Vikalpa means non-objectified knowledge. Really, it's not knowledge. You hear a word which has no basis, which has no corresponding object, which is absolutely meaningless, but then we identify ourselves with that. We identify ourselves with a non-existent something. That is vikalpa. And Patanjali says, all these are different modifications that we accumulate in our mind. Later he will tell. As I said earlier, a non-dream state can be completely divorced, completely separated from our waking state experiences. But non-dream experience is an exact repetition or a duplication of waking state experience. There are differences with regard to time, space, etc., between dream experience and waking state experience. So if somebody is obsessed with an idea, even if he doesn't do anything during waking state, he will imagine himself to be engaged in activities related to that idea. So that could naturally come to the surface during dream state. Because in dream state, our senses are completely inactive. Mind alone is the player in dream state. So all the imaginations and ideas that we live with, that we develop in waking state, can come to the surface in spite of themselves, without our control. We have no control over what we experience in dream state. People who have practiced a lot of spiritual sadhanas in waking state, reading the lives of great saints and spiritual masters, in dream state, suddenly they may feel that they got an instruction, they got some teaching. And if that teaching completely transforms their lifestyle when they come back to waking state, then it should be interpreted as real. After all, dream state is not something non-existent. If an individual lives for 90 years, and if he lives for 8 hours every day, if he sleeps for 8 hours every day, say let's say dreaming, you won't say that he lived only for 60 years because his waking experience lifespan was 60 years, but he lived for 90 years. So dream does have a place in one's life, no doubt about it. But then there's only one difference. Dream state is more subtle. Waking state experience is more concrete, gross. Dream experience can never be a duplication of waking state experience, but can never be completely separated from waking state experience. Because the raw material for your dream experience we gather in waking state. thought currents, tendencies, impressions we gather in waking state. And when we dream, they come to the surface, they project at the mental level. That's the idea. So there is no complete separation, but there is no duplication either. That's the idea. So if you have any more questions, we'll discuss. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.